me. And so as we consider those things of Paul's news, we're kind of almost taking a step back and thinking of the story so far. We did that a couple of weeks ago when we looked at Paul's journey to Philippi. We kind of tried to think about the people who had first heard the gospel there. And now we're going to pick up a bit more of Paul's story, really, in some ways, and think of the story so far, the things that have happened to Paul. And just to sort of think those things, after Paul had left Philippi on his third missionary journey, the church had been planted on his second journey, then he'd been back a couple of years after that on a third journey, and he'd visited Philippi and a few other places, as you might expect, on that journey. And then he headed back to Jerusalem. So since they'd last seen him, what had happened? He'd got back to Jerusalem and had been lynched by a mob who had claimed he'd brought Gentiles into the temple. He was arrested by the Romans, kind of to keep him alive, in one sense, but that did mean he was also arrested on a false charge, which hadn't actually happened. He hadn't brought Gentiles into the temple at all. He was arrested by the Romans and taken into prison. Even though it was a false charge, and even though no one had ever asked him anything about it, he was nearly flogged as well. Then there were several attempts to have a trial. And Paul was shuffled from one court and judge to another, and they never really got anywhere. Just one court hearing after another, and no one seemed to really be able to take matter into their own hands and release him or anything like that. They just thought, oh, perhaps we need another person to hear in on this. And so in the end, Paul appealed to Caesar. All this time, Paul was in prison in Jerusalem, later on in Caesarea as well. How long that took is a little bit hard to tell, really, in the Bible. But it could have easily been several months. Paul is in prison awaiting trials of various sorts. During those same times, Paul also survived an assassination attempt. Again, the details are given in the book of Acts, that actually one of the reasons why the Romans moved him from Jerusalem to Caesarea was that they heard a report that there was a large group of men who'd taken a vow that they were going to murder Paul. And so they shipped him out to a new prison to try and keep him safe. In the end, he was then moved to Rome on a prison ship. So it's no cruise of the Mediterranean. And they set off in winter, despite Paul's words of caution. As they journeyed across the Mediterranean, he was shipwrecked on the island of Malta, and everyone survived and made it to the shore, whereupon Paul was bitten by a poisonous snake, and yet survived that too. They stayed on the island of Malta for a few more months before another ship arrived to take them on to Rome. And there he then arrived in Rome, and he'd now been waiting 2 years. That's what we hear at the end of the book of Acts. Whether it was more than that, we don't know for certain. But that's when the story comes to an end in the book of Acts. And he's under house arrest in Rome. That gave him a little more freedom, but it certainly wasn't a picnic. He was probably under house arrest because there were far too many prisoners in the prison already. And so it was just overflowing. And so now Paul was in a rented house, but he still refers to the chains and guards that were with him at night and day. So, those are the things which happened to me since he'd last seen them. Over the last few years, that's the kind of things that happened to Paul. And yet, Paul very humbly doesn't mention those things at all, does he, in his letter? Just gives us a little summary, the things which happened to me, almost putting them to one side. I said, we might sort of look through it a little bit just to get a bit of the context and the story of what's been happening to Paul, and because the people in Philippi knew these things. But Paul seems to just put them to one side and said, oh, never mind all that. I want you to know, brothers, that the things that have happened to me have helped advance the gospel. Now, that's a positive way of looking at things, isn't it? There's no poor old me from Paul feeling sorry for himself that huge long list of things that had gone wrong, most people would say, and those difficult things that had happened to him over the last couple of years, Paul says, I want you to know that all of those things that happened have helped advance the gospel. While Paul had been in prison, he then wrote these letters. And there's four of them we often refer to as Paul's prison letters. There's Ephesians, Colossians, there's this one, Philippians, and there's Philemon as well, the very short little letter. And all four of those were written while Paul was in prison. Sometimes people think this is the last one, because he mentions more of what might happen next, which we'll come to in a minute. And it's interesting as well, in this letter, that 16 times Paul talks about being joyful. 16 times in a prison letter. Almost sounds like a contradiction in terms, doesn't it? There's Paul in prison, and so many difficult things have happened to him, and yet in this letter, we hear so much of Paul's sort of mentality in those things, of rejoicing even in those difficult situations. And that can be something for us to think about too, can't it? I think perhaps sometimes we can get disillusioned and downcast about things and struggling with one thing or another, and I say difficult things that happened. But are we those who are looking for reasons to be joyful? So Paul tells the story so far, but he gives with it two reasons to be joyful. And that's all linked, isn't it, to that what we just read in verse 12. I want you to know, brothers, that the things which have happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. The gospel is advancing. That's what Paul wanted to use. He uses a military word for it. Just like, maybe we'll come on to in a minute, just like the Roman soldiers, perhaps he rubs shoulders with a bit more now. The Roman army had a fantastic ability just to conquer so much and just to advance and bring Roman civilization to lots of the Mediterranean and places around it and things like that in an sort of unstoppable way. But here Paul uses that military word to talk about the gospel. That the gospel's going out and nothing can stop it. And Paul says, that's why I rejoice, verse 18, and I will rejoice. I'm not going to stop rejoicing. So let's look this morning at those two reasons that Paul found in prison to be joyful. The first one's in verse 13, that more were hearing of Jesus Christ. So the things that have happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, verse 13. So it's become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. One way the gospel had advanced was that more people now were hearing of Jesus Christ. Paul talks in verse 13 of the whole palace guard. Again, he uses a military word, the whole praetorium, the whole of the sort of the Caesar's royal guard and things like that, who kept the prisons and things like that too, kept peace and order in Rome. Loads of them had now heard about Christ, that my chains are in Christ. We can only really guess at what he might mean by "and all the rest." It's become evident to the whole palace guard that my chains are in Christ. That kind of makes sense. But who are all the rest that he's talking about? Whether it's someone further afield in the city of Rome, Paul rejoices. Now, I think most of us, if we were under house arrest, chained to the wall, or chained to a post or something like that, constantly watched by a guard, I think that might get us down, right? No privacy, no freedom. Being constantly watched, constantly guarded, having a big burly soldier standing next to us that we're handcuffed to. And Paul rejoices. Paul rejoices because of it, these guards were hearing the gospel. What an amazing thing. Paul can sort of turn something round, can't he? And see the way that God was using it. And it's also quite interesting to think of it from the other point of view. Think of the guards for a moment. Busy job. Working in Caesar's prisons. He had a lot of prisoners. And so they had to guard all kinds of people, didn't they? Think of one of the guards. One day he's guarding a chap called Bill. And the next day he's assigned a new duty to be chained to Paul. And they came to know, verse 13, that his chains are in Christ. How did they know that Paul was a prisoner for Jesus? Paul must have spoken to them. Can you imagine Paul doing that directly? We also know in the book of Acts that other people could visit Paul while he was in this house arrest situation. So people came from the church in Rome. Other people could visit him, like Luke, who wrote the book of Acts. And there's Epaphroditus, who's mentioned later in the book of Philippians, who visits him and things like that. So there's lots of people who can visit Paul while he's there in prison. So perhaps some of the times the guards who are there handcuffed to him are overhearing Paul as he chats to other Christians, as he talks to them. Maybe they overheard Paul as he prayed. Maybe they looked over Paul's shoulder as he wrote his letters to make sure there was nothing dangerous in them and things like that. And so all the time they're just mopping up this stuff, listening to Paul, being talked to directly, hearing all of these different things, seeing Paul and the way that he was. They knew he was in prison for Christ. Paul was a different sort of prisoner to all the rest. There was something different about him. They would have seen his character, seen the way he conducted himself, seen his life, because they had to be with him 24/7. And they knew he was in prison with Christ. That phrase he's used is that my chains are in Christ could work two ways. That he's chained there because of Christ, but also essentially he's chained there with Christ. And the language could work either way. And so Paul rejoices. And when we just think of that for a moment, think of Paul's witness there under house arrest. Is there a bit of a challenge for us as well? I live in my house. Someone else lives in the next house along. But to other people on the street, do they know there's any difference? Or you sit at one desk in your office and somebody else sits on the desk next door to you. Do they know anything different about you? The guards knew that Paul was different. They knew his chains were in Christ. Do we too have that kind of witness through our attitude, through the way we work and things like that? Do people notice if we were in hospital, we are lying in one bed and someone else is lying in the bed next door? Do the staff, do visitors notice anything different about us? They notice it about Paul. Are we those who through our witness and through our words show that we're in Christ? Not necessarily chained in Christ, that was Paul's way. But we're there in the office with Christ. We're there in the hospital bed with Christ with us. And in all of those different things, do people know that we're connected to Christ? Do we share something of our faith? Is something of it evident in our situations? So these guards and all the rest, and lots of others too, were hearing the gospel. Paul had always planned on going to Rome. There was a church there already in Rome, long before Paul gets there. And he wrote them the letter. That's what we've got in Romans. And in it, Paul talks about wanting to come and visit them. And he wanted to come to Rome. And maybe he had in his head all the ways that would work. As it was, he went to Rome as a prisoner. But perhaps even Paul could laugh, in a sense, at how God had used that to advance the gospel. Maybe there were people, like the guards, who'd heard the gospel because Paul was a prisoner. And they wouldn't have heard the gospel if Paul had gone there in freedom. They were the ones who'd heard it now. And the gospel was advancing. And people were hearing of Jesus. Paul has another reason to be joyful too. Carries on in verse 14. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. So many people were hearing of Jesus Christ. Second reason to be joyful, many people were speaking of Jesus Christ. Other Christians had seen Paul in prison, heard of Paul in prison, maybe visited him in prison, And because of that, Paul says in verse 14, they'd become more confident. They'd become more bold. They now are confident to speak the word without fear. Carries on verse 17, knowing that I'm appointed for the defence of the gospel. Knowing that Paul was there in prison defending the gospel seemed to spur other people on to greater evangelism and greater activity, speaking of Jesus. And Paul gives thanks. It might seem that in some ways he was now handicapped and couldn't spread the gospel as he wanted to, rather restrained by things, literally by being chained up, which wasn't really the case because he's still getting opportunities. But even while he's chained up, other people are now experiencing more freedom, in a sense, to go out and share the good news. Now, Paul knows there's two motives going on. Some of those were friends. He says in verse 15, some do it out of goodwill. Verse 17, some do it in love and in truth. So there were friends of Paul's, who now Paul was stuck in prison, they sort of felt called to fill the gap a bit and to help out and to genuinely help in Paul's absence. So there were some friends who were doing it. Christ was being preached, he says in verse 18. In truth, Christ was being preached by these sincere, loving friends of his. And Paul rejoices. Christ is preached. Woohoo, Paul would say. He's being preached, and I rejoice. But Paul does know there was another motive too. Some of these people who now become such exuberant preachers were rivals. Verse 15, he says some of them do it out of envy and strife. Verse 16, they do it from selfish ambition. They're not sincere. Verse 18, they're kind of pretending a bit in what they're doing. He says in verse 16, they want to add affliction to my chains. It sounds a little bit odd. We might wonder, what exactly are they doing? But Paul still calls them brethren in the Lord, verse 14, and still says they're preaching Christ in verse 18. So they're Christians. They're just not being like Christ. Maybe they resented Paul arriving in Rome. Such a popular, famous Christian, an apostle like Paul. And so now Paul was in prison. They kind of thought, well, now we've got our chance. In Paul's absence, we can get a bit of a following, maybe. So now Paul was in prison. They were out there preaching. Oh, come and listen to us. We're going to teach you about Jesus. Don't worry, you don't need anything to do with Paul. Don't listen to him. Forget about that strange bloke in prison. Come and listen to us. You don't need him. Come along to our church. It's a much better one than he started. We're much better Christians than him. It was a bit weird. Sounds a bit strange. Sounds a bit messy. Sounds a bit sad. And yet, Paul rejoices. It's not great, is it, when one Christian is bad-mouthing another for their own advantage? It's not great when one church grows deliberately at the expense of undermining another. But Paul looks round and says, Christ is being preached, and so I'm going to rejoice. Even if they're doing it in a bit of an underhand way, and even if some of their motives might be a bit questionable, at least they're preaching Christ. And they presumably were still doing that properly, even if they weren't necessarily being a very good illustration of Christ. Paul doesn't mind. Verse 18, what then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and in this I rejoice, yes, and I will rejoice. It's a decision there, isn't there, as well? I will rejoice. I'm determined. Could that have got Paul down? You bet. Could have, knowing there were people sort of undermining him and being a bit malicious. And Paul says, no, I will rejoice. Because Christ is being preached. Do we look for reasons to rejoice? Perhaps when we're in difficult situations too, and challenging things happen to us. Do we look around for reasons to rejoice? Do we look for good news? Do we look for this kind of thing? For people hearing of Jesus? For people speaking of Jesus? Because that's some of the best news, isn't it? Best things to look out for. Sometimes even if there are funny motives and things that could get us down, do we rejoice? Are we determined in it too? Paul also looks forward. What might happen next? The next chapter, we thought of the story so far. Well, what might happen next? What could happen to Paul while he's in prison? What might the future hold? And Paul, quite bluntly, thinks about two options. That is life or death, verse 20. And that might sound a little dramatic, but it was true, wasn't it? For Paul in prison, one option was that he'd be released. That either he'd get his trial with Caesar, or Caesar would just acquit the case, or something like that. That Paul would be released. And sometimes people talk about getting your life back, don't you? That would be for Paul, getting his life back. Getting his freedom back. And he could do whatever he liked. He'd have life. He'd be a free man. The world would be his oyster. What did he want in life? As a new phase of freedom opened up in front of him. What did he want? To live is what? What would we say when something new opens up for us in life? What is it we want? What do we think would make life worth it? What do we want to achieve in life? To live is a bit more money. Life would be great if I had a promotion. Life would be fantastic if I had more influence. If I could have my time again, I'd try and have more friends, or I'd try and have more holidays. What is it that we think would make life worth it? What is it we want to live for? What is it we want in life? Paul says, to live is Christ. I want to live for Jesus. To live is Christ, verse 21. If I live on in the flesh, verse 22, that will mean fruit from my labour. Verse 24, it will be more needful to you, the Philippians. Paul wanted to live for Christ. He wanted to be useful. He wanted to be fruitful. He wanted to be a blessing to the church in Philippi and hoped he could get back and visit them again. If he had life given to him. You might think of that in the initial sense, that way Caesar gives him his freedom. Of course, Paul knows ultimately that's from God, isn't it? If God gives him life, what will he do with it? He'd live for Christ. Paul also thinks of the other option. There he is in prison, whether by life or death. And again, he's not being over the top. There he is in prison. Paul could be executed. He could have his trial before Caesar, and Caesar could just say, yeah, off with his head. Caesar didn't even necessarily need to have him for a trial. Caesar locked off many people's heads without that. There was every possibility. Paul could be killed. He could die. And yet, how does he talk about that? Verse 21, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Verse 23, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Paul could be executed. And he knows that one thing that could happen in the future. How does he talk of it? He says, then I'll depart. He's not looking forward to death itself, possibly being executed, possibly in great pain and things like that. But by that, I'll depart. I'll leave. It was a word that came from camping. Paul was a tent maker. That's why he uses it. It's this idea of striking camp and moving on. And Paul's been there living in a tent. And then he's going to strike camp. He's going to take the tent down. He's going to leave it. Because he's going to go home. He's going to depart. And I'll be with Christ. That was the thing that he was filled him with longing. I'm going to depart. I'm going to be with Christ. And it's going to be better by far. That's what Paul looks forward to. What an astonishing way to talk. And yet perhaps it's something we need to recapture, don't we? We're so used to what the world says about life and death. And often the world uses this idea of losing, doesn't it? People have in their obituaries and things like that. The so-and-so fought a battle with cancer and then lost. That's the idea. They lost the battle with heart disease or whatever it is. Not for Paul. He says, I'm going to win the battle. Even if Caesar lops my head off, die will be gain. I'm going to die and win. I'm going to die and I'm going to gain. Because I'm going to be with Christ. And that's the best thing ever. This world will end. I'll depart. I'll leave this place. And then I'll be with Christ. That's the first thing I'll see. I'll be with Christ. Paul thinks, actually, when he considers these two options, that one is more likely. He doesn't know what to choose. He says that. But it's not really him to choose. He says in verse 19, I know this will turn out for my deliverance through your prayers and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Paul thought he would be released in answer to their prayers, and perhaps the Spirit of Jesus Christ, perhaps he thought that that's what Jesus wanted for him. He says in verse 25, being confident of this, I know I shall remain in the flesh and continue with you for your progress and joy of the faith. And your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ when I come to you again. So that's what Paul thought was the more likely option. And it does seem to be the case. That did happen, as he thought. But most importantly for Paul, he doesn't know that for certain, but he says, verse 20, my hope is that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but with boldness as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body. Whichever way. Whether it's life or death, or maybe there was 101 other possibilities perhaps that could have happened. But I want Christ to be magnified. I want to live for Jesus. I don't want to be ashamed of him. And so as we come to an end this morning, what's the next chapter going to hold for us? I don't know if we often think about it. Perhaps sometimes at a new year, we think about what might the next year hold, or perhaps when we have a birthday, we think, of what might the future hold for me in the next few years and things? What would I like to do, and so on? Well, in some ways, the same two options lie before us all the time, don't they? Because we don't know the future. We might think of all the things we'd like to accomplish, but we don't even know if we're going to live tomorrow. Life and death lie before each one of us, don't they? So how do we finish those sentences? To live is what? What is it we want to live for? What is it that we have on our resolutions of things we want to achieve in life? What are our priorities? Paul says to live is Christ. That's what matters most of all. And to die is what? Death is unknown, isn't it, to all of us? We don't know when our life might come to an end. Are we ready to die? Paul was. Paul was ready to die. He knew there was a distinct possibility he'd die in prison. He was ready for that. Are we? No idea how long our life may be, when it might come to an end. In an unpredictable way, in an unknown way, none of us know. Are we ready for death? Can we say die? To die would be gain. Yeah, we're not looking forward to the death bit itself, but then to depart. And then we'll be with Christ. Can we say with Paul, that'll be better by far. That'll be the best thing ever, to be with Christ. Would God help us to have that right perspective on the next chapter as we think about our future with all of its unknowns? Are we those who have that biblical view, that mindset, to live is Christ, to die is gain? Let's sing our last hymn that again reminds us that Jesus is the one who's with us, just as he was with Paul in prison. He was chained there with Christ. And whatever the future holds, he knew, even in death, he would be with Christ. And so let's sing this hymn that sort of picks up that theme. I found a friend, oh such a friend. He loved me ere I knew him.